and welcome to the Football New South Wales Community Podcast, covering the great people, organisations and initiatives from around the football family. My name's Teo Pelizzeri, and it's great to be back in 2024. This was an initiative that Football New South Wales started last year, where we got to meet the staff within Football New South Wales and also the key administrators at the various associations, learn about the territory that they cover and the important role they have in providing football to so many thousands, tens of thousands of people around New South Wales. In this podcast, I do have a co-host and we will have a guest. Hello to Aaron Dibden, the Head of Community and Member Services at Football New South Wales. Aaron, great to have you on.
G'day, Teo. Great to be with you.
So tell us about your role. How long have you been at Football New South Wales?
So I'm coming up to 5 years here at Football New South Wales this year, started in 2019. I was previously the General Manager of the Eastern Suburbs Football Association. So my roots are in community football, and I'm now the Head of Community and Member Services, looking after a team of, I think, seven staff. And we've got areas ranging from club development, online services to diversity and inclusion and junior participation.
Was this always the role when you started with Football New South Wales that you've held for the 5 years, or did you actually come in with something different?
The role sort of evolved a little bit. I started off in a narrow role that didn't look after the member services space, and also we've added the club development space just in the last couple of years.
So your time with the Federation has included COVID and then the return from COVID?
Yes, indeed. I remember many, many video conferences with associations trying to talk them through all the different things we were going to need to do, and especially in 2021 when COVID interrupted the season, and we were wondering if we were ever going to get back on the park. We kept on having these meetings where we were like, oh, another 2 weeks, we're hoping to have some information, and then eventually we're just like, nope, stick a fork in it, it's done.
Would it be fair to say that it is actually, now that we're in 2024, it's starting to feel like a distant memory, that we've had 22, 23 sort of clean start to finish seasons, that the lingering effects of having to shut down a couple of years, football in this state has moved through that?
Yeah, it now does feel back to normal, and we're back to our sort of previous strength, which is a great relief. You know, in my time here, we've had everything. We've had bushfires at the end of 2019, and we had things like we had to cancel a summer football champion of champions because it was bushfire smoke. Then we went into COVID and lockdowns, and one season that started late, another season that got cut short early, and then we had floods and all sorts of mess at the start of the 22 season. 23 was our first properly good year in a long time, and I think everyone got on the park and enjoyed themselves. We had great player numbers, and that's carried forward into this year.
Just a little bit about you. Tell us about Eastern Suburbs and what had your connection to sports administrating and also football been prior to that general manager role?
Yeah, so it's a funny thing. I'm an accidental sports administrator. I was a player at Sydney University Soccer Football Club, just in the all-age teams. And I'd worked in federal and New South Wales public service prior to that. I'd gone back to uni to study, and I was looking for a bit of part-time work. Picked up a job doing some admin at Eastern Suburbs Football, and wound up being, you know, a year and a half later, I wound up being the general manager there and stayed there for 10 years and wound up coming up to this glorious place.
it's certainly, I think a lot of people's experience in football administration was, it was there and I started doing it.
Yeah.
And whether it's a club, whether it's an association, you know, everyone's got a backstory, but fantastic to hear what that's well over 15 years of involvement administrating the game.
Yeah, and more than 30 years playing as well. So I don't think you last long in these sorts of roles unless you really have a passion for the game. There's too much that happens that you need to be able to just knuckle under and go, I'm doing it for the love of it.
Tell us about some of the sort of key signposts and events that your department takes care of. Some of the, you know, KPIs in terms of, you know, what you are measured on, your team and what you look for. I guess, you know, high level, because before we bring in our guest and we get into the depth of some of the more recent things we'll be talking about, tell us about what your department is hands-on handling at the moment.
So a regular thing that we do all through the season is we send development officers out to do community activations. And so if you see a Football New South Wales inflatable or various, you know, Football New South Wales staff doing clinics and so on community grounds through the winter, that that's going to be coming through my team. We also do various diversity and inclusion activities, like we're supporting the Football Australia Minoroos Multicultural Settlement Program, bringing newly arrived migrants to the game and linking them up with our clubs. The Football for All Gala Day sits under my team as well, which is one of the best events of the year here at Football New South Wales, where we get roughly 500 players with various abilities to come and enjoy their football here at Valentine Sports Park. It's an amazing event, and if you haven't been, you really ought to come later this year. And also just this year, we've added the Club Development Conference as a new addition to the community football calendar.
Well, that might be the first thing we lead off with when we bring in our guest. On the other side of this short break, you're listening to the Football New South Wales Community Podcast.
Day after day, Kappa rewrites the concept of sportswear. Kappa means teamwork, past, present, and future. Kappa never stops, because winning starts within. Two people, one brand. Kappa.
Welcome back to the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. Here at Valentine Sports Park, we have Aaron Dibden, the Head of Community and Member Services for Football New South Wales, and our guest is David Mason, the CEO of the Manly Warringah Association and Manly United FC. David, thanks for joining us.
No problem, Tayo. Aaron, how are you going, guys?
Very good, very good.
So before we get into some of the key topics that relate to community and member services, just give us the quick snapshot of how long you've been the CEO at the association, and also how big your association is in terms of clubs, players, staff. What's the current snapshot of how you're looking at the start of 2024?
Well, I've been in the role for 6.5 years, which sort of seems to have flown. It only seems like yesterday that I wasn't here, but 6.5 years I've been in the role, thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a fantastic place to come and work every day. Our player numbers last year were just a tick over 19,000. If our current trajectory continues, we'll crack 20,000 for the first time this year. But as we say, it's not important to be the biggest, it's important to be the best. So if we get over the 20,000, that'd be fantastic. But if not, we'll just make sure that we put on good competitions for our footballers on the Northern Beaches.
For those listening from other parts of Sydney or other parts of New South Wales, what is your geographic catchment? Where are your borders?
So we're basically from Mossman, so we're the Sydney Harbour, all the way up. We don't cut across the North Sydney. It's like the Mossman suburban geographical area, all the way up the Northern Beaches as far as Palm Beach. And then we sort of French's Forest, Seaforth is sort of our western boundary. So like the northern suburbs and the Gladesville associations, we're quite tall but narrow. But we've got a fair area that we look after, and it's a pretty good cohesive football ecosystem that we've got.
What would you say are the sort of the short and medium term challenges, and maybe some of the long term aspirations, whether it's to do with facilities, whether it's to do with clubs and how they administer themselves, whether it's to do with your competitions and how they evolve and how they look, or the age demographics of who you're providing football for? What would you say are some of the short and medium term things that your association is sorting through on hand, and then what are some of the big dreams for what comes in the future?
Well, one is volunteerism. I think that's something that's becoming harder and harder as people get busier and busier, and society sort of moves away from people rolling their sleeves up and helping out, particularly at club level. There's a lot more work and governance that needs to go on for grassroots clubs, and, finding volunteers isn't an easy thing. So our clubs that are successful in that regard are the ones that take the time and effort to make sure that those helping are getting a good experience, whether that be with incentives or just creating a fun environment. The volunteerism is one challenge, but our biggest, the biggest challenge, I think, and it's not just ours, but it's everybody's, is trying to create a competition structure where every age and every division has enough players so that you can create competitive competitions. That means having enough in each age group to ideally have three divisions. So you've got your you know, your talented players, you got your run of the mill players, and then you've got the players who are literally just playing for social reasons. So in the the teenage girls is one area which we're really happy with of our growth over the last few years. We've been able to play every age group from 13s up. We don't play 17s, obviously, the same as the boys. And believe it or not, the sort of the men's and women's over 35s are getting to the point where it's really difficult. You get three or four really, really talented Division One teams and nobody wants to play against them. So that's our biggest challenge, is trying to come up with competitive competition so that everybody has an experience every year where they want to come back. And not everyone wins. The one thing that we say to our players and our clubs is, I can guarantee you that someone will win it and someone will come last. But you want to try and keep it as competitive as possible so everyone has a decent experience.
That's maximising the number of weekends where you turn up either not knowing what the result's going to be or knowing that you're a chance, as long as you give it your best. How you mentioned wanting to be the best as opposed to necessarily the biggest. How close would you say your clubs and your association is to max capacity in terms of every pitch being used for every plausible minute of the day? Are you maxed, or do you have growth potential? Where would you say you're at in that respect?
We've got, there's two answers to that question, Tao. One is obviously training space. Because you're limited to just a few hours in the afternoon and everyone wants to train Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So in terms of training space, some of our clubs and, you know, us in general are, you know, starting to struggle a little bit. But that just means that, you know, some teams need, if they're going to train twice, they'll need to pick a Monday and a Friday. But the clubs do a fantastic job at sorting that out and who trains on what fields. In terms of weekends, we've got a pretty progressive thinking association in that we've done a lot of work with council to upgrade lights. So we've got, you know, we've got 35 pitches that we can play games on Friday night. Obviously we play all of our women and girls on Sundays. So everyone's expectation that they play at 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock on a Saturday has sort of been driven out of them over the years, and some competitions are Friday. So we've spread out different days so that we can maximise our games on the pitches that we have. We've done some work with council around getting some better access to some of the schools on weekends for matches. So at this point in time, match-wise, we do have some area for growth, which is lucky because we're about to go through a pretty big one.
Dave, have you found that the expansion of competitions onto time slots like Friday nights has helped with some of your volunteer issues? Because it might free up, say, with your over 35 men, it might free some of those blokes up to become referees or coaches and help out with running your junior comps?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Aaron. We use our Friday night slots purely for strategic reasons. Our under-18 Division One competition for men and women, we have an under-21 competition for the boys. We play those on the Friday night because obviously kids in that group are leaving school, starting uni, and they need to work, and most of those jobs happen on a Saturday. So we move those grades and those divisions to a Friday to allow kids to, as part of our strategy, to keep kids playing. And we also started a 35s Friday night competition a couple of years ago, those that would like to be able to get their game done on the Friday so they can do coaching, refereeing, volunteer roles on Saturday. Probably at the back end of this season, we're going to do a deep dive to see after 2 years how many of those players are actually fulfilling roles and fulfilling referee coaching and volunteer jobs on a Saturday to see if it's worthwhile continuing with, because we think we can better utilise that Friday night slot in other ways if that's not working.
Well, I think this is a pretty good segue, what we've been discussing, into the Club Development Conference. So, Aaron, tell us, what was the Club Development Conference? How many days, how many clubs, how many people, and what was its purpose?
Yeah, so thanks, Teo. The Club Development Conference was an idea that we had to try to support the club development platform that Football Australia rolled out last year called Club Changer. And Club Changer, the idea of it is that we have clubs go through and do a bit of a self-assessment to see how they're tracking against various metrics. In the first place, they go as women's and girls, and they do a self-assessment, they set an action plan, and then once they've done that, they can be credited as a one-star club. But there's more to it than just women's and girls, and we wanted to look at things like child safeguarding, we wanted to look at governance, we wanted to look at player and spectator behaviour around clubs. And so we thought a really good opportunity to set a day to bring people here to VSP to come and talk about how their clubs are working, learn from each other, learn from some expert speakers as well. And so we set that for mid-February this year, and we got more than 150 representatives from clubs and associations to come along, which wasn't bad for a first swing, and we're hoping to go better next year. But the feedback, I can genuinely tell you that the feedback has been universally positive, with the exception of one thing, and that was the hall was bloody hot on the day. But it was an excellent day, and lots of really, really good discussions had. We had people from all over Sydney and New South Wales. Like, we had people coming from Dubbo for this thing, and they all came and they learnt and they had a good time, and they brought great lessons back to their clubs.
David, your impressions of what the Club Development Conference offered, and have you had any feedback yourself from your member clubs?
Yeah, we had five clubs that were there, five of our 16 clubs this year. They were there, and the feedback from them, and I think it's probably one of my beliefs, and when you go to these conferences, is that it's a really good opportunity to sit and listen to what other people are doing. I think as a sport, we can do better in listening and learning and taking advantage of each other's experiences. So I thought that part of it was fantastic for our clubs to be able to sit that back and listen to the group of speakers that Aaron and his team had, but also in the breaks, you know, discussing. I saw a couple of our clubs talking to a couple of the other clubs about how they go about things. And I think the more, you know, it's a life lesson, not a football lesson. The more listening you do, the smarter you become. So I thought it was fantastic in that regard.
Dave, I think I want to just leap off that point, because I think that's a really good point to emphasise. You know, in this game, I've said a few times in various forums that football's often a bit of a circular firing squad. Like, we're always really quick to take shots at each other. And like you say, when we listen, we actually wind up learning from each other that there's some really special stuff happening in different places, and we're not always the font of all wisdom. So when we come to those things with sort of open minds and open ears, we wind up picking something up that might be absolutely golden, and we can take it back and we make our club or we make our association stronger.
So in terms of tracking how this is sort of taken back and implemented, and what happens for 2025 and what happens for future editions, what are some of the things you'll be looking for and some of the things that your team will be tracking to measure the success?
Yeah, so some of the stuff we've... every club that's come along to the Club Development Conference, we're going to be reaching out to them and ensuring that they wind up engaging in the Club Changer club development platform. But also beyond that, we'll be reaching out to the associations and saying, for the clubs of yours that didn't come along, for a start, come and get involved in the Club Changer platform. But also, we're locking in the date already for the 2025 conference. It's going to be on the 1st of February next year. So our comms are going to go out really early for when that's on, get to save the date in. And we want to make sure that we can get an excellent program, which sort of builds on and expands from the platform that we built this year to make a really exciting day and ensure that people can really see the value. We're also going to be talking to clubs that did attend this year to sort of see what were the things you want us to emphasise, what are the things you want us to build on, to make sure that will enhance the experience for all the clubs that attend in 2025.
David, just drawing back to one of the points you made around volunteerism and the challenges facing clubs to find people to do these roles. People respond to, you know, different stimulus in different ways. Some people might hear our conversation and that could be their point to say, all right, I'm going to put my hand up. Other people might respond to, you know, more formal materials if they're provided with the Football New South Wales logo on them, if they're, you know, provided in the form of a video or a, you know, a flyer or, you know, a website page. Do you have any thoughts on sort of which delivery method of the message might be the most effective, or which you have seen get traction within your community, whether it is, you know, word of mouth, formal, or a mix of both?
I have absolutely no doubt that the best way for clubs to increase volunteerism is to do it internally within their own club. The people who are going to volunteer at football clubs are the people that have been there for a while, have got kids, have a sense of community about them. Because that's what our football clubs are. They're community groups. In some areas, they're the absolute fabric of a community. I think if you corporatize it a bit too much, for want of a better expression, if that's even a word, I don't know if that does the job. We find that the clubs over here that are having no challenges getting volunteers, the ones who actively source them from within their club, and once they're there, making sure that they have a good experience and they feel like they're not just attending a meeting and ticking a box. People who volunteer are the people who are selfless, happy to help out, but they want to feel like they're part of something. So our clubs that do really well are the ones that that try and get as many as possible, and more people doing less work is better than having three or four people doing six jobs and trying to do everything themselves.
Aaron, anything else that we haven't mentioned about Club Development Conference that you want to get out there for anyone who's listened to this conversation and wants to know more?
Keep an eye on the Football New South Wales website. We're going to be putting out a whole range of resources that follow the Club Development Conference, sharing some of the presentations that went up, but we're also going to be putting out a club support hub with a set of documents and resources that clubs will be able to pull down and have a look at. So this gets to your point, Teo, about some people will listen to a podcast and they'll draw something from that. Some people will want to read something with a Football New South Wales letterhead or look at some good pictures, etc. So we're going to be reaching out with resources in a range of different ways.
Let's move on and talk about registrations. Aaron, rather than spit the stats at you, I want you to grab out some of the important numbers that you think tell us about the direction that football is going in New South Wales in 2024.
Yeah, so probably the single thing is just an amazing headline. We're about 25,000 players ahead of where we were this time last year. And we know that the Women's World Cup, well, we always knew that the Women's World Cup was going to have a big impact on registration numbers. We felt, as football people, that excitement. We felt that football was just in everyone's blood for a month of last year. Well, that carried through into a really strong summer football season, and now winter football has gone mental. So 25,000 extra players have registered compared to the same point last year. The really exciting part of that is that the female growth is huge. And Dave, I'm sure you're seeing in your space, all age women and senior women generally are up about 20% over this point last year. So women are just absolutely flocking to this game, and it's really exciting to see. It's exciting to see that people are seeing their heroes on TV and in stadiums, and they're seeing that football is a place for them, and they can come and have a great time. And it really doesn't matter your standard. You could be a Matilda, and you can also be a woman playing in the over 35 Division 3 competition. Just come and enjoy your football. And I'm really proud of the fact that our game provides such a great space, such a welcoming space, because, so many of these people, they're going to be beginners, and they're going to come and they're going to enjoy their football and hopefully stick around for many years to come.
Oh, absolutely. We have a club meeting tonight. So we do a bit of a dice of our regos every Monday in this time of year. So today we're more than 1,000 players up on the same corresponding Monday last year. We've already gone past last year's registration numbers, so all things being equal, we'll hit 20,000 players this year. We're seeing growth, good growth in the women's, but we're also seeing good growth in the men's. In particular, the most encouraging age groups where we're seeing growth is the teenagers. That's boys and girls. Like our women's 18s, for instance, is up 32% on last year. That's significant around a time where girls in particular, but boys, and it's every sport, they get to that age group and they start to drop off. But I think one of the things that the Women's World Cup did was that it made playing football cool for teenage girls. And full credit to Football Australia for their "You Can't Be What You Can't See" campaign. A lot of girls used to drop out of playing football because it was, I'm not really sure I want to do that anymore. It's not really that cool. But now we're just seeing our retention rates in teenagers, particularly for the girls, has been amazing. And Aaron, we're sort of pretty consistent with the state average in terms of the women's all ages. You know, that's up significantly as well. The other place where we've got a massive increase, we've started our girls only women's under sevens this year. So now the girls have their own women's and girls competition starting at seven, whereas the previous year it was eight, and previous to that it was 10. So now, you know, what part of that was a shift, we needed to shift some players to the Sunday, but also give young girls the knowledge that they're playing in girls competitions. So in that age group, boys and girls together, we're 230 players up from last year. So
really interesting that you speak about sort of the cultural and societal impact, because one thing I was going to ask is, as these numbers continue to rise, and we all know that football's great strength has been huge participation sport, but at times has struggled to capture sort of the national zeitgeist and has always been kind of seen as an other or an outsider or a challenger sport to the establishment. Do you feel as though when you see the numbers increasing the way they are, when there's demographic shifts the way that they're going, that tipping point of football is a key part of this country and it is not simply something you can pigeonhole as a participation sport, that moment is actually around the corner and is happening before our eyes?
Teo, to be brutally honest with you, we've always been massive in participation. And both of our national teams are amongst the most popular teams in the country. So right at the top and right at the bottom, so to speak, we're already there, and I think we have been for a while. I think what you're alluding to is the professional side of the game, and that's something which, you know, as a sport, I don't want to get too controversial, but we had it a few years ago and we've lost it. So I think we need to work to try and get that back. But if you talk about participation, we've got it. We've always had it. And our national teams, as I said, are much loved. And it's not just the girls in the recent Women's World Cup. You know, the last Men's World Cup, they got through the knockout stage. You know, the width of the post or the width of the goalkeeper's leg, you know, sends us to extra time against Argentina, who go and win the thing. So I think we've got the top and the bottom. I'm not sure what the key is to unlocking the professional side.
So, well, let's stick with the grassroots, because that's one area I wanted to circle back to finish this chat. And we heard you speak earlier about the three-tiered sort of objectives that you had for some of your competitions. When you hear a term like social football, what do you both, I'll ask you both this question, what do you define it as? And do you have it in your mind sort of what sort of the aspirational experience is, or is that something that continues to evolve with the changing swelling numbers that you have?
I know I used the word social before. It was probably the wrong word for me to use. Everyone who plays in our sport in our area, it's not social football. That's what you go to a futsal centre to play, or that's what you go to a local park to play. All of our divisions, you know, in some age groups down to Division 4 and Division 5, they're run with competition tables, and people play sport because they want to win games. I don't think that the social aspect of it is just as important in the men's Premier League competitions as it is in the boys under 12 Division 5 and the girls under 14 Division 3. The beauty of our sport is it is social. As you meet people, you hang out with people, you're not at work, you can let go of all of your hassles that you have throughout the week, and you go and play football, and that's social. Some people are better at this sport than others, which means they play in Division 1. Some people, you know, when you get into the lower divisions, they want to play in social groups. They want to play with their school friends because they just want to play with those set people. So I think that's one of our challenges in putting together competitions, is getting that mix right so that everybody actually has a good experience, whether they're a Division 1 player or they're just playing with some friends.
Dave, you're 100% right. And I am one of those players who's been playing now for 35 or so years. And just I do play for the enjoyment, but I play to win as well, and, you know, always have. And my daughter's now started on the journey as well. She's playing in under sevens in my club up on the Central Coast. But that experience of making sure that you can make the environment a good competitive environment to be in, where everyone feels like they have a crack, but they're there with their mates, and like you say, they do get to kind of put the troubles of the week behind them and instead chase a ball around a park for 90 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever the length of the game is, and just really enjoy themselves. Like, people don't do what isn't fun. If people come along and they sign up for their football game, whether it's, you know, Premier League in Manly Warringah or whether it is, you know, the over 35 Ds, etc., they're not going to keep doing it if it's not fun. So we do need to look after that player experience at all levels of the game and you know, build good clubs and good competitions to make that happen.
One last one, David. The floor is yours for anything else that the Manly Warringah Football Association might be doing or have coming up that you just want to get on the record, or anything that we haven't touched on as part of this chat that you feel still needs to be said about the state of play at the moment.
Over the next few years, I think it's important that we continue to work with our council to start upgrading amenities around in our area. We've had a scheme that's been in place way before I started, where we have a facilities fund. Every registered player contributes $10 a week, which goes into a fund which we've used to upgrade lights, which we've used to do a whole heap of things in our area with council. And I think now we're at the stage where I think 95% of our fields are lit. So that's allowed us to not be bursting at the seams. Now I think we need to really push forward with having facilities where every club, so we have 16 clubs, and every club's main field should have an amenities building where two teams can get changed. There's a men's and women's toilet, there's a canteen, and there's a modest storage facility. That's sort of going to be our push in the next few years, to start working with council to get that achieved.
That really builds up the nerve centre of each club, right? So you rock up and there's a hub of activity where, yep, everything is driven from. You've got your canteen, you've got your shed, you've got your change rooms, and that will feel like home for so many people, and there'll be the smell of sausages and denkarub. But, you know, that's home for people of a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon. It's such an, yep, important thing, you know, getting those spaces right and getting that feeling of a place you really do come home to every second weekend. I know that's one of the things I love about the game. You know, when I go down to my home ground, that shed is my space of a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky. I use the word lucky, but a lot of people have worked hard over a long time in this area to get that. But, you know, the vast majority of our clubs do have those amenities and they do have that facility. It's just now us working with council to identify where the gaps are and where the holes are, and then try and fill them in using some of our funds, but also unlocking government funds at every level.
David Mason, thank you for being so generous with your time on this chat, and we appreciate you joining us on the Football New South Wales Community Podcast.
No problem, Taya. Thanks very much.
Big thanks to David Mason, the CEO of the Manly Warringah Football Association and Manly United FC. Aaron Dibden is still here. Aaron, thanks for having this chat today. Anything else you want to flag before we finish up, if people have had their interest piqued by listening to this podcast?
Yeah, Taya, we're just all here in the community team, catching lots of incoming inquiries and making sure that we can help clubs and associations out with anything they need. And so if you have any queries or questions, please reach out to any one of my team here at Football New South Wales.
Aaron Dibden, Head of Community and Member Services at Football New South Wales. Thank you for being my co-host on this podcast. It's always great to have members of the Football New South Wales staff come in and help drive the discussion.
Very welcome. Pleasure to be here.
And we hope you've enjoyed the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. Many of the episodes from last year are more or less timeless, very similar chats with other associations and members of the Football New South Wales team. So by all means, subscribe. You'll be able to get hold of any upcoming episodes, but also go back and have a listen to some of the other chats we've had over the journey. My name's Teo Pellizzeri. Thanks for your company. We'll speak to you soon.